it is Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Chronicles, where today we're going to be talking all about Timon of Athens by William Shakespeare. Now, before we get into it, I just want to say thank you to Tim, who I do believe sent me this copy many, many months ago and, you know, said that it was a play that he had a particular fascination with. And so thank you, Tim, for sending it in. It's been wonderful to read through because it's actually the first time that I've ever read this play. That's not actually so unusual. Not only is Timon of Athens one of Shakespeare's most divisive plays amongst Shakespearean scholars as to the actual quality of it itself, but also in terms of the fact that it is by far and away one of the least performed Shakespeare plays. And that is a shame, because there is actually a lot to appreciate here, having read it now for the first time. But I can undoubtedly see why. Unlike when we covered Macbeth with Harry, or Romeo and Juliet, of course, those two being very, very famous Shakespearean plays, and it feels like they never let up. Whereas with this one, there are moments where you can see inconsistencies in the writing, where some aspects of the play do feel a little bit more developed than others. However, Shakespeare or no, I wouldn't bring this to you if I didn't think it was actually worth discussing. And it really, really is, because the themes that Timon of Athens deals with and the actual main characters, such as Timon and the cynical philosopher Apamantus, make for, not only are they brilliantly written, but they ask some very, very important questions and sort of perennial questions as well. And so I'm really looking forward to discussing all of that with you. Part of the reason why Timon of Athens is not entirely ubiquitously well-received, and also why it's perhaps less performed than other plays, is because from the first copy of Timon of Athens that we actually have, which comes from the first folio, this compendium of many of Shakespeare's plays from 1623, well, it seems unfinished, right? That there is speculation that actually this play was never finished. We have no evidence of it even being performed in Shakespeare's lifetime. From what we understand, the first performance of Timon of Athens was all the way over in 1674, long after, of course, the Civil War and even the Restoration, trying to think, 50, 60 years after Shakespeare's death. So it didn't exactly hit the ground running when it came out. There is a theory that actually a good amount of Timon of Athens, the actual writing of it, is not Shakespeare's actual hand, and that this play may have indeed been a collaborative project, and the person who's most speculated to have fit that person, that mystery other writer, is Thomas Middleton, who went on to become a very, very famous Jacobean playwright in his own day. And one of the things that points towards Middleton being the other man on this project is that it favours a lot of Middletonian contractions. You see the way that it puts oeth and stuff like this, the way it's a th to thee. This is something that Middleton does a great amount. Also in the banquet scenes, they really lend themselves to a particular genre of play that was very popular in the Jacobean period, known as city comedies. And these were something that Middleton himself absolutely excelled at in plays like A Mad World and My Masters. So there are those aspects of it too. The other thing is that this may explain in having two separate writers working on it simultaneously. And on top of that, the fact that it seems that the play may never actually have been performed. It might have been discarded, it may have been finished, but simply never had any revisions put to it. There is a lot of conjecture, and all of these questions are asked by scholars far more capable than myself. But to just simply give you the information on this, one of the things that people often point to as evidence of there being two writers, other than the things that I've just outlined, is also the fact that when it comes to the talents, right, this measurement of money, these large sums of money, there seems to be a bit of an inconsistency there. For example, at the beginning of the story, Timon of Athens gives 5 talents to pay the debt of Ventilius. However, he also then goes on to pay 3 talents for a dowry, and this is made out from the reactions of people around to be a sizable chunk of money. However, later on in the play, we see the same measurement, the same unit of talents being used much more broadly, like 500 talents, and this is seen as actually not a great deal. So there seems to be some disagreement between the hands that is working on this as to the very idea of how much a talent is actually worth, which would have been a large sum of silver back in the day. And they've obviously got their own metrics and their own way of measuring it within the story, without seemingly a great deal of cross-referencing with one another. But this is all conjecture. This is all speculation. We truly don't know. For it may well have been an entirely Shakespearean work. This is something that people will probably continue to debate for long hereafter me recording this now. But let's just actually talk about some things that we do know for certain. For one, Timon of Athens, long before he became the main character of a Shakespearean tragedy, was a very often cited figure across sources from antiquity. This is very famously the case in Timon the Misanthrope by the Greek satirist Lucian. And he also features briefly in Plutarch's Lives as well, where he's talking about the life of Alcibiades. And in fact, the extract is so short that I'm actually just going to read for you now that part from Plutarch's Lives, so you can get an idea of the sources that Shakespeare was working from. Plutarch's Lives was one of Shakespeare's main resources. It was always one of his go-tos when he was writing anything about the antiquity period. This is also true of Coriolanus and his play Antony and Cleopatra, which were also being written around this time, right? That Shakespeare had this phase of writing these antiquity plays, amongst also, just to say, this is also the period of about 1605 to 1608, when Shakespeare is writing many of his most famous tragedies as well, such as King Lear. I'll just read you this part from Plutarch and then we'll carry on. Now, Timon was an Athenian and lived about the time of the Peloponnesian War, as may be gathered from the plays of Aristophanes and Plato, for he is represented in their comedies as peevish and misanthropical. But though he avoided and repelled all intercourse with men, he was glad to see Alcibiades, who was then young and headstrong, and showered kisses upon him. And when Apemantus was amazed at this and asked the reason for it, Timon said he loved the youth because he knew that he would be a cause of many ills of Athens. This Apemantus alone, of all men, Timon would sometimes admit into his company, since Apemantus was like him and tried sometimes to imitate his mode of life. And once, at the Festival of the Pictures, the two were feasting for themselves, and Apemantus said, "Timon, what a fine symposium ours is." "It would be," said Timon, "if thou wert not here." We are told also that when the Athenians were holding an assembly, he ascended to Bema, and the strangeness of the thing caused deep silence and great expectancy. Then he said, "I have a small building lot, men of Athens, and a fig tree is growing in it. from which many of my fellow citizens have already hanged themselves. Accordingly, as I intend to build a house there, I wanted to give public notice to that effect, in order that all of you who desire to do so may hang yourselves before the fig tree is cut down. After he had died and been buried at Helia, near the sea, the shore in front of the tomb slipped away, and the water surrounding it, and made it completely inaccessible to man. The inscription of the tomb was, "Here, after snapping the thread of a wretched life, I lie, yet shall not learn my name, but my curses shall follow you." This inscription he is said to have composed himself, and that in general circulation is by Callimachus. "Timon, hater of men, dwells here, so pass along, heap many curses on me, if thou wilt, only pass along." And so you can get, just from that short extract, an entire flavour of the temperament and manner of Timon, and also his relation, or lack thereof, to the other Athenians and men of the city. And what we have here in Timon of Athens is of a man who is the entire opposite of this depiction. It is the man who is endlessly benevolent, endlessly magnanimous. He is philanthropic to the point of absurdity in comedy. And it's the story of how that man is betrayed and will become the man that Plutarch outlines in his Lives, as a man who becomes that sinister, cynical, and cantankerous and venomous character. Who will go on to die and have a tomb by the sea away from society, right? He's not buried in Athens, in the city. He is away from the city, away from civilization, on his own, where he might finally have some peace. And as it says there, even lay your curses on me and then just pass along, but just make sure that you pass along. Not a sound guy, not one you'd want to spend any amount of time with whatsoever. But there is another reason why Shakespeare is writing this play, other than the fact that it makes for a very colourful type of character from antiquity, which is, of course, the themes that it allows Shakespeare to explore, and Middleton, indeed, if he didn't collaborate on this, which is the fact that, well, it has somewhat eternal questions to ask about credit and debt, and to what extent gold and gift-giving actually seal friendship with one another. One of the things that's spoken about at the beginning of Catherine Mouse's analysis of Timon of Athens, who writes the preface for the version of Timon that is in the Norton Complete Works, is one of the things that Catherine says is the fact that whenever you see an advertisement, right, and you see the man giving the woman the golden ring, or you just see a man giving a woman an expensive gift at all, or indeed just a gift amongst friends, right, we have in it, it only works on our minds. If I were to go into Waterstones and look on the shelf and find a copy of Timon of Athens and give it to someone as a gift, then that would be probably appreciated. But if I went out of my way to look online for a really, really old copy that was worth hundreds and hundreds of pounds, and I were to give that as a gift, then that would prove to be probably a stronger display of that friendship. It speaks in some way of the fact that because I am willing to pay so much money into a gift, that is somehow corollary with how much I value that friendship, right? And this is something somewhat eternal. The more expensive the gift, then it is, but it's also something else as well. It's not just that. It also can be a reflection on your own sense of pride, your own ability to give, to provide to people, to tell them that, yes, I have within my power the ability to lavish this bounty upon you. And the word bounty is used constantly throughout the play Timon of Athens. And the other thing as well is the fact that Timon is in doing this, and when we meet him at the beginning of Act One, he is constantly giving and giving and giving, but he never actually receives any gifts back. And so he's constantly keeping people within his power. Only he is allowed to display his own magnanimity. And this entire social arrangement of giving gifts is all illusion. It's all an illusion because behind it, Timon finds himself in a great amount of debt to his creditors. And this would have been a very topical aspect of conversation at the time when the play was written for a Jacobean audience, because as Catherine Mouse points out here in her analysis of Timon of Athens, in the first decade of the 17th century, the traditional aristocratic virtues of open-handed generosity and carelessness of expense were coming into increasingly acute conflict with the limited means upon which the great nobles could actually draw. As England became an international trading power, luxuries once unheard of became available to people with the money to buy them. As tastes grew more sophisticated, noblemen who wished to impress peers and subordinates with the splendour of their bounty were forced into ever greater expenditures. The result was an extraordinary expansion in the credit markets. The worst offender in this respect was King James, who, rather like Timon, showered his favourites with expensive gifts, a habit that created staggering deficits in the royal exchequer. By 1608, royal indebtedness had reached crisis proportions, and other members of the upper aristocracy were likewise floating on a sea of debt. As I say, this is one of the main aspects that the play directly deals with in a brutal and a very blunt manner, and perhaps may even explain why this play may not have been performed. Perhaps as a subject, it was too close to the bone for many of the aristocrats and even the king that it would have likely been performed to, especially with Shakespeare and his company being the king's men at this time for King James. So, and it might have seemed a little too on the nose, even compared to a play like Macbeth, which was at least able to tell a story in a way that was kind and honourable to King James's own ancestors, mythical ancestor of Banquo, and also the fact that it comes together with a unity of the Scottish and English at the end to restore order. So whereas with this one, it's speaking to a genuine warning about what happens when that balance between the creditor and the debtor falls into an openly parasitical nature. And we see that reflected in also the way that a character like Alcibiades, who features prominently in the play, is constantly railing against the fact that the senators of Athens have allowed Athens to become so corrupted by usury as to basically need a fresh start. And Alcibiades is going to bring his army in, scourge the Senate of its corruption, and start again. But these are all things that we can get into much, much more when we talk about the actual analysis of the play. So let's now talk about the play, every act of it, go through the synopsis as we often do. I will read some of the soliloquies and, put on some of my voices, and I hope you enjoy the story.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.